Well, it is Thursday, which means, as we do one Thursday a month, we get together with Lindsay Simon from Balanced Life. Good morning.
Good morning, Jen. Thanks for having me on again.
Hey, thanks for coming in through the smoke and the traffic and the road work and everything. We're getting a curb.
Right. We get a couple complications in the summer here in South Lake, right?
I think it tires us out.
Yes, and then it makes you late to things, too.
Try as you might. Yeah, I had to meet somebody at Smart and Final yesterday to do a little pre-meal shopping. And, I left my house, and I thought, okay, 15 minutes should be adequate from my house to Smart and Final. I just live up off Cold Creek area. And it was going really well until I hit the highway. I like how our highway is, like, the slowest part of everything.
I know. I'm using the road construction in South Lake, and also, the smoke is a great opportunity to practice coping skills with my clients, to practice acceptance and mindfulness of just it's out of your control, and just make the best out of it.
What are you going to do? That's really what it comes down to. What are you going to do?
Yeah, get a podcast on that you've been waiting to listen to, a book on tape.
That's it. And, we have so much convenience now. I know you're not supposed to text or call or use your phone while you're driving, but if you're sitting at a stop, we have the ability to let people know, hey, I'm running a few minutes late, stuck in the construction.
Mm-hmm.
Where I look back, I don't know, when did phones come around? 20 years ago now?
Let me think about that. Yeah, 20 years ago,
something like that. We didn't have the frustration was more real then, when you had no way to communicate that this is what's happening. And you didn't have podcasts then either, so it was different.
Well, and I think there's just a different level of expectation as well, because there was no phone, so people just, it was more acceptable to be late. And then, say, afterwards, people said, oh, they might be in traffic or something. Something must have happened.
That's true.
And so there is probably not such a, they should have called, because everyone has a phone now.
Well, there is that. Yeah, that is... People want you, and they want you now.
Mm-hmm.
That I'm kind of over. I've explained to several people, this phone is here for my convenience.
Right.
Not yours. It's hard. It's hard with me. You really have to intentionally disconnect.
Yep.
That people text you, and it's like, why aren't they texting back?
Well, they're finding lots and lots more studies and research coming out that suggests that on a daily basis, you put your phone away for at least an hour, completely off and away while you are able to do some relaxation, because it really does distract. They've shown that as the phone is out when you're talking with someone, it actually decreases the level of intimacy and deeper connection you have with that person, even if it's on silent. So even having it just in view.
And you're like,
yeah, just having
it. You don't know, I'm moving my head.
Right. So even if it's just in view, because when people send texts, it lights up, right? But even having it in view can remind you of other things you have to do and people you need to call. So if you're trying to have an intimate evening with someone, put the phones completely away and off.
Yeah, very, very smart. And I know it's when you have kids, it's hard because you're always waiting for the next shoe to fall. And then you need to hear them. Then we have things like, I have my Fitbit on, and you're like, whoa, what are you looking at?
Right.
And my texts and phone calls from my cell phone come to my Fitbit.
Right, and so that can be distracting.
It is distracting. I'm looking to see that my daughter's like, oh, let's go to breakfast. It's like, did you forget that I work? I don't know. Small lapse of memory that actually work. But it's an interesting thing. We are so connected, and people want us. They want us now. We don't want that fear of missing out.
Yep.
Is huge.
FOMO. Yeah. FOMO is real.
I think we all have it. It's like, oh, gotta know what's happening.
Right, and grass is always greener. It comes along with that. There's something better going on than where I'm at.
Yeah, that grass is greener thing. Well, that's a nasty thing.
Mm-hmm.
As we look at people's social media and just like, oh, look at my,
Yeah.
That's why I have to remind myself, people are posting their highlight reel.
Right. So that is one good thing. And then, the antidote to that is gratitude and gratefulness for what you do have and where you are, and whether that's in smoke and traffic I'm grateful I get to listen to this CD again, or much music I haven't listened to in a while. And I'm grateful I have this car to drive. And I'm grateful that I have pay for the gas in the tank. And, you know, going through what you're grateful for what you do have. I'm grateful I get to be at work right now, be to be able to pay bills when there's pictures of people on a boat or something, right? So
sure.
Being yeah. grateful for what you do have and where you're at is the antidote to that FOMO.
Well, there we go. That'll keep you a little happier, because I'm going to lead into what you're going to talk about, because it can be depressing.
Correct.
When you look at, you know, wow, look at this classmate, how wonderful they are, how excellent their kids are, and everything looks perfect. And you have to back up, because I know it'll bring me down. And then I realize, okay, well, what do I post on my social media? Pictures of my kids. Look how great they are. My grandson, look how cute. You know, so they're looking yeah. at mine probably the same way. You know, I'll tell people this over and over and over again. You look at folks who think, oh, this is perfect. Look at the perfect family. You do not know what goes on behind closed doors.
Right. We know no one's perfect.
No.
That's the only thing we do know.
Stuff.
Everybody's got stuff. And, you know, we're seeing extremely high increase rates of depression in children or teenagers, you know, middle school and high school age. And theoretically believing it's directly linked to social media. You know, we don't have direct scientific evidence of this, but the correlation is pretty outstanding. So, and for females, even more than males. It's about twice as high, I believe, for females, teens, around 14, than males. And
so we should send Mark Zuckerberg the bills.
Right. Wouldn't that be nice? So being able to have, you know, they don't have a filter, and the emotion regulation and coping skills and that cognitive functioning ability
sure.
to logically go, oh, those are people putting up their best posts. Oh, this is not reality, right? This isn't kind of best. And what can I enjoy right here? Those higher level functioning, called executive functioning skills, they start developing around 12 or 13. And then and a male brain isn't fully developed that part until 24.
About 16? Oh, sorry. Yeah. I didn't say that.
I mean, Tahoe male brain might be a little different.
70.
But I think the average is about 24, and it keeps growing. You know, for females, I think it's between 19 to 21 that the prefrontal cortex gets developed. So there's a lot of work to do, and that also means that social media affects those kids much greater, and
sure.
it's much harder. And so I really encourage parents to really have limits and not just give kids access to social media and have limits on that, because they really can't manage it. And we're seeing more and more depression. And so today what I thought I'd talk about is, because the word depression is thrown around pretty easily, also the word bipolar, right? Oh, he's bipolar. I think he's bipolar, right? People say that about anyone who acts kind of irrationally or maybe has anger outbursts. They're like, ooh, he's really bipolar. When they're saying that, let's talk about what bipolar is today and what clinical depression is today. And we say clinical means diagnosable according to, you know, what we use as mental health clinicians and what a physician will use to diagnose, compared to when people say, oh, I'm so depressed. Because oh, I'm so depressed means feeling depressed right now. That's just one emotional state. To be depressed, have major depressive disorder, is a whole kind of syndrome of clinical symptoms that has to last at least for most days for 2 weeks long. And that's when there's clinical depression, the brain is sick and it has differences in its, we can actually see chemical makeup differences and differences in activity than a non-depressed brain. So it's actually sick and it needs to be treated.
Mm-hmm.
And the treatment is a combination of psychotherapy, which is talk therapy, for classic depression, cognitive behavioral therapy is known to be extremely effective. And a combination of medication is the most effective. Now, some people, just therapy will help treat their brain. For other people, just medication. But most people, I think it's around 80, in the 80 percentile, it's the combination is most effective for clinical depression.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about it.
Yeah.
What does this look like?
So when we go through kind of this, we have a little symptom checklist that we go through. So every time a client comes in, I actually give them We call it PHQ-9. So if anyone wants to go online and give themselves a PHQ-9, so it's a patient health questionnaire -9, you can do it online. It gives you the results right there. It's a screening for depression. And what they're looking for are these 9 symptoms. And in order to be diagnosable with depression, you need 5 of them lasting at least 2 weeks. So the first one is sleep problems. Now, that could be more than just depression, right? There could be, sleep is also associated with anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, ADHD, straight up just insomnia. That's the only symptom. But we're talking about a cluster of symptoms. So one of the 9 that go with depression, sleep disordered, that could mean either sleeping too much, needing more sleep than usual, or not enough sleep. So it can go either or. So it's just disordered sleep, we call it. All right. So the next one is therapeutically we call anhedonia, which is really a lack of interest in things that you used to find pleasurable or interesting.
Lack of interest. I'm writing that down. So
we'll often hear, I just don't feel like doing anything anymore. Like, oh, I used to like painting and it doesn't really interest me anymore. I just don't feel like going out anymore. Like, it's just that kind of like not really feeling like it, not having motivation and that feeling like doing anything anymore. So it's actually a symptom of depression. And then we have feelings of guilt and or worthlessness. We put that in as one kind of, and there's specific questions we kind of ask, but feeling excessively guilty about things, especially ones that logically might not make sense, but you feel it. And it might, you as a person who's depressed, you might not say, this isn't logical. You're like, I feel really guilty about, but you'll hear it in the way they're talking. Or feelings of worthlessness, like nobody loves me, it doesn't really matter, right? So then you'll have low energy. If you have high energy, then we have to look more at the bipolar side. But with low energy, feeling still tired, even if you're sleeping enough or not sleeping enough, you're just feeling really tired, lethargic throughout the day. Concentration problems, difficulty starting, completing tasks, paying attention, and concentrating. Appetite changes. So that means even inconsistently eating, having no appetite, having a really big appetite, overeating, stress eating, any of that. You'll see weight changes over time if it's not treated. And then we have your body actually starts becoming either agitated, like you can almost like feel it in your body, like,
you're walking up with your
it's that
shoulders are hitting your ears. It's like,
which is also a symptom of anxiety disorders, but we're looking at just depression right now. Or your body could do the opposite, which is feel really lethargic and like heavy, like you're dragging yourself around. And then you might have what we call somatic complaints, which is unexplained physical pains like stomach aches and headaches, and back pains. That's related to mental health disorders, and specifically we're talking about depression here. And then suicidal thoughts. So in suicidal thoughts, we have passive suicidal thoughts and active suicidal thoughts. Passive suicidal thoughts are more vague, like I just don't want to wake up. Like I'd be fine if a bus hit me. Like this isn't worth it anymore. So these are more passive, just wishing you weren't alive, wishing it would just go away.
Yeah.
And active is I have a plan and I'm intending to do something about it. So I have, you know, I would use a rope and it's in the other room and tonight I'm going to do it. So we talk to clients very openly and blatantly about this, because the more we have that open relationship, the more we come up with safety plans with clients. Mm-hmm. And so all of those are the symptoms together. Now, 5 of them need to be present for at least 2 weeks.
What if you have all 9?
No, 9, that's severe depression.
Just a second.
So if you wanted to take the PHQ-9 screener online, you could just look up PHQ-9 screener, and it gives you kind of a, you know, it's a 0 through 24. And if you're, you know, 18 through 24, you have it's severe depression. You have moderate depression, you have mild depression.
Now, you talked about, you know, we're going through this list. It needs to be over a period of time. It's not like, today I feel this way and then I'm okay tomorrow, and then maybe next month I kind of have a day where I feel like this again.
Right. So it needs to be at least for 2 weeks most days.
Okay.
Each those symptoms. So if you just feel this for a couple days, then that's not depression. Because there's a lot of things that happen to us in life where we will experience those similar symptoms. Well, sure. Loss, grief, we get in a fight with a friend, right? Mm-hmm. A fight with our loved one. Then we feel like that, but it's only a couple days.
Yeah.
And we work through it, or we go and talk to our therapist and work through it that way. And those are kind of situational. That's more, we call it an adjustment disorder, when we're having a reaction to a situation in life. Depression can be triggered by multiple things. It can be triggered from trauma from the past, from, it's just genetic. Sometimes it just appears out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. It can be triggered from grief, the grief that extends longer than 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Right? And then it goes into depression. And so what we want to look at the therapist, that's why you really want to go to a therapist. Those screeners will just tell you, do you have the symptoms? But a therapist will look at the whole picture and be able to kind of really see what's going on. Is this major depressive disorder? Is this grief and loss? Is this part of something different? Like sometimes there's head injuries that can cause these symptoms.
Yeah, I was talking to a psychiatrist, and concussions can mirror a lot of these things, and kind of an interesting, that's why she's kind of dealing with both, because it's like, how do you kind of make your way through that?
Right, and oftentimes, so the first thing an effective therapist will do when you come to the office and they see these symptoms, they hopefully will ask, when's the last time you saw your physician? Because we really want to rule out any medical issues that would cause these.
Sure.
Because these same symptoms can also be from thyroid disorder. And,
yeah.
You know, there's other diseases, you know, Lyme disease and things. There's other things that can cause similar mental health conditions that need to be ruled out.
Yes. That's a lot to do.
Right.
Rule out. Let me, you talk about this PHQ-9. When people fill it out, I mean, this is, I'm asking kind of your opinion on this.
Yeah.
Are people pretty honest on them? Or do we fall in? I know as a woman, I'm fine, good, yeah, great.
I think that's a really good question. And from, I can actually assess people's openness level and self-awareness from when they fill it out, and then I have a session with them. And when I look at the PHQ-9, it's all zeros, means they're saying, everything's fine. But then I talk to them, and they're, say, crying a whole session and and telling me how they haven't slept in 3 weeks. And I'm looking at the PHQ-9 about that just gives me information that they're trying to portray themselves in a different light or have very low self-awareness. So that we have a lot of work to do on identifying emotions and a lot of minimizing might be happening. So that happens a lot where people are like, oh, it's not that bad. And then when I talk to them, I'm like, no, this is valid. What you're feeling is really bad. You know, this is, that sounds horrible what you're going through. You know, I just really validate their experience. And then you'll start see almost sometimes they mark the symptoms worse, but really they're just becoming more in tune with their own body and not putting up a denial, minimization, defense mechanism.
And I know in the past, I'm familiar with this form, and I've done it with somebody where they've done theirs, and the doctor or therapist has asked me to, okay, you fill it out for them.
Yep.
How do you rate? What do you see? Because it is interesting, some of these things that may happen, and I guess I think more in kids where they don't necessarily have that self-awareness going on quite yet, whereas as a parent or an adult in their life, you notice these changes in these things, and you're able to say, yeah, that has changed.
And I think that's a great point, is that with children, especially in therapy, that we want parents checking in with the therapist to give updates on what we see, because and when you're in it, it's really hard to see it too. It's kind of like anything you're in.
Yeah.
You know, if you're in a bad relationship, it's really hard to see it's a bad relationship until you're out of it and you're like, what was I doing?
Yeah, and all your friends going, it's a bad relationship.
Right? All this feedback. So it's kind of like when you're depressed, all your friends are like, I think you need some help. You know, you should probably talk to someone. You're like, It's not that bad.
Yeah, hey,
I'm fine.
I had a great person tell me once, he asked me, how you doing? I was going through some really yucky stuff in life, and I'm fine. He's like, fine is not a feeling, it's a type of hair. I'll just remember that. I'm just like, okay, that's not a good answer. So now I try it, and whenever I see him, I'll never say I'm fine.
That's good. Yeah. Great. So the other thing that a therapist can do is they can bring in collateral resource, which means they can have a partner come in, you know, every six sessions or so to check in and say, what are they observing? I always like to, when I'm meeting with someone who has a healthy partner, to say, can we bring your partner in? I just want to see what feedback they give. And they usually give something that the person wasn't aware of. They're like, oh, yeah, I forgot I was hadn't slept in 3 days. These like really big things. Get a Fitbit,
it'll remind you.
or especially if there's substance abuse involved, that's really helpful to have a partner and be like, you know, I'm really concerned about this. And then they're like, okay, well, that's a huge factor in this as well. Because, you know, that's another factor with those symptoms. We also have to rule out substance abuse. Because if someone's drinking, that could be solely the source of those depressive symptoms.
Yeah, that would do it pretty much for all of them.
Yeah. It's a depressant, so if there's an alcohol abuse problem. So with mental health, we really can't see what's really there until there's sobriety, until we get kind of remove all the substances, because sure. anything can be substance-induced, any of these symptoms.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
Lots to learn.
Lot to go. Yeah, it's an interesting thing. So we talked about clinical versus feeling.
Yes.
And obviously clinical, you've said, okay, you have these 9 symptoms. It was 5 or more mm-hmm. for a period, you know, ongoing for a period of 2 weeks.
Yep.
But any of these, like you said, could be a result of things happening in life.
Right. And that's really where going talking to a professional, whether it's going to talk to your physician about it or a therapist or someone, can help you piece together the pieces. Because there could be, you know, we want to find out what's the underlying cause of this, really, is one thing. And then we want to treat it. So getting treatment is important. But you can just feel, you know, one day you don't have a good appetite. Maybe you're able to recognize, oh, I have a speech tomorrow. That makes sense. I'm nervous about that. So if you're able to kind of make sense of it, but when you can't make sense of it and there's just symptoms there, then being able to go and ask about it, you know, start with going online and taking the screener, and then being able to go and seek out help. You know, that's a really big strength.
So, okay. I've got all kinds of questions. So you talk about making sense out of it. So if you can look at your life, though, and this is probably when you haven't dealt with something completely, mm-hmm. where you can say, okay, yes, I've got these symptoms, but then you're still pointing back to an event, say 10 years ago or something, mm-hmm. As to why you've gotten to this point. So it's basically because you haven't dealt with it then. Would that be a safe assumption?
So that could be. You're talking, I think, more about unprocessed trauma.
Okay.
So if there's something that occurred, and it might be ongoing too. For example, if you grew up in a house with lots of domestic violence, that's ongoing exposure to trauma, which definitely affects the way that your brain gets programmed and essentially gets stuck, wired incorrectly.
Sure.
And so there's definitely an incident that then led to and has not been processed and you want to work on. And that's the therapist that you want to work on trauma work with. And so that there's specific types of therapy that specifically address that unprocessed trauma, and the most one of the most effective ones is EMDR, and that's if you have the coping skills already. And a good EMDR therapist is someone who they first up your coping skills so you can tolerate thinking about the trauma, and then it's a very specific format where they activate your left side of your brain, then your right. They can either put their hand back and forth in front of you, they put headphones on, activate the left side, then the right, as you go back and share your story. But it happens in a way it doesn't re-traumatize you and actually processes the trauma after you're given the coping skills. So you'd have to look it up, EMDR, but that's specifically for trauma. There's trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, but you specifically for something like that want trauma therapy.
Now, the EMDR would probably be something it'd be used for PTSD, I would assume.
Yes.
Okay.
That's what the VA uses as their most, because it's the most very, very effective form.
Interesting. I'd love to see it done. I've kind of observed that. It's going to be fascinating to me.
You can YouTube it. You can YouTube watch it.
I'm old. I forget about YouTube. Someone else is like, oh, just put this in YouTube. I'm like, okay.
Right? So you can learn more about that. And yeah, once that's specific, most of the theories that, you know, I use, cognitive behavioral therapy, dialectical behavior therapy, are more here now theories. So the type of therapist, psychoanalytic therapy, is a totally different ball game than what we use at A Balanced Life is Here and Now Therapies, which is it's helpful to understand where your behaviors come from. Uh-huh. However, change is made in the here and now. So we work on not so much going back and fixing childhood stuff, but unless it's trauma work, that's different.
Yeah.
But, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy is your thoughts and cognitions in the here and now, identifying the unhelpful ones and finding more helpful thoughts and behaviors. What are your behaviors right now that are causing problems or leading to negative consequences that are self-destructive, and identifying and practicing healthier behaviors. So cognitive behavior therapy is a combination of that. Dialectical behavior therapy is an offshoot of that, which is all about coping skills and relaxation skills, mindfulness skills, so that you can handle everything in the here and now.
Yeah, that's good, because I like this. So let's switch gears a little bit.
Yes.
We've got the depression thing going on, which is interesting. You look at this and I'm sure a lot of people are like, oh my gosh, am I depressed?
Right. And if you're thinking that, then I do suggest contacting us at A Balanced Life and we can help you figure that out.
Well, and I think that's a good idea in a sense, because it may be clinically, clinical diagnosable depression versus, okay, this happened and this is kind of what I'm wrestling through, and not allowing it to maybe progress to a clinical depression.
Right, because we can a lot of times, there could be what starts as an adjustment disorder or grief. However, it goes into depression because it's not addressed. Avoiding dealing with it, avoiding addressing it. And emotions need to be processed. That's the way our brain is programmed. It's just being human. That when we ignore emotions or pretend it's not there, they fester. And when they fester, they come out as sleep problems, insomnia, irritability, depression, anxiety. So emotions need to be processed. We need to tell our stories. We need to make sense of them. We need to let them process.
Yeah.
So it's just how we're programmed. And so if we don't do that, what might be just called an adjustment disorder, like a reaction to just one event, could turn into clinical depression.
And now you mentioned that we talked a little bit about bipolar.
Yes.
And you mentioned when you were talking about low energy would be the opposite would be high energy, and that would be perhaps a symptom of being bipolar.
Correct. So bipolar is considered a mood disorder. Both depression and bipolar are under the mood disorder category, which means they are a problem of mood regulation problem. So it's a mood dysregulation problem. Now, depression is when your mood is lower, right? Mm-hmm. Now, bipolar means you not only get depressed, and so there's some people with bipolar that don't get the depressive symptoms, but that's really rare, and I've yet to see them because they don't really come to therapy because they're manic and really happy. But with bipolar, you get typically a depressive episode and then also a manic episode. So it's kind of like your mood can go down and then really high. And it can be either manic or hypomanic. A full-blown manic episode is where there's the symptoms of easily distracted, can't concentrate, high levels of impulsivity. So you'll, especially with pleasurable activities, you'll see sex impulsivity, spending lots of money, buying cars and things, and you'll see just lots of impulsive behaviors. Grandiosity, that's an inflated self-esteem, thinking like, oh, I'm Superman, I can run the world, I can do it, whatever, I'm special, thinking you're special, inflated self-esteem. You'll see lots of ideas too, and racing thoughts, like, oh, I don't want to do this, and I want to do this, and I want to do this, and I want to do this. People from the outside will see someone more talkative with pressured speech.
Uh-huh.
Like, oh, yeah, I'm going to do this and this. I think it probably looks similar. You got to, again, rule out that they're on meth or speed because it looks similar. But this is someone that is not drug-induced acting like this. So this is biologically induced, basically uh-huh. their brain chemistry. You'll see more activity levels. They're doing lots of things, moving around, cleaning their house and moving things around, and they're going to go do this, and they're going to do this, and they're going to go running in this. So, like, lots of high activity.
Oh, I kind of like my kid to be in the manic stage where they clean house. That would be all right.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that comes with a lot of negatives. Yeah, no, that whole impulsivity thing is dangerous.
That part's not good. The cleaning's good.
Right. There'll be a decreased need for sleep. This is the key, though, and they still have lots of energy. So even though they
bless
might...
their hearts.
Right. So someone who's hypomanic, the sleep might go down to 5 or 6 hours. But someone who's fully manic, it might go down to 1 to 2 hours to almost no sleep for a couple of days. And a manic episode can last anywhere from hours to weeks. And so you really see this long, and it's throughout their life, they would see it's not necessarily, it can be drug-induced into a manic episode, but it cannot be, if that makes sense. But once they're off the drugs, if they're still on a manic episode, that's brain-induced. But
yeah.
And they could be show up as being more irritable too, because so it's not necessarily like everything's great and awesome. They could just be like super annoyed and irritable, which also irritability can be a symptom of depression. So it's more so, are they not sleeping and have more energy and their brain is going really fast and racing, where you want to think of lethargic is more depression stuff.
Okay.
And so the key is with bipolar is, it's typically, it's really genetic and biological. You usually see there's some mental health in the family previously. So we always ask about that. What's your family history? And there could be psychosis from depression. If you're depressed enough, you can be get into psychosis, which means hallucinations or delusions, or with mania, you can have psychosis. So a lot of people mistaken, they think just because someone has psychosis that they have schizophrenia, which is not true. Psychosis can occur, which is hallucinations, delusions, from being manic, from being just depressed. It can occur completely on its own. It can be drug-induced. Marijuana, we know, induces psychosis. And about, I think the rates are like 25% or something at this point.
Well, that's comforting.
The marijuana, it's so strong now. They're so powerful that people are not realizing that most people who have the potential in their brain to be, they have carry the genetic coding for schizophrenia, marijuana will trigger it, whereas it wouldn't have been triggered otherwise. So it's a really big, it's a huge deal in the mental health community to be aware of how much, if you have a history in your family of any kind of psychosis, that marijuana is not a good drug of choice.
I hope you're weighing in the discussions that are going on throughout the city on how to handle these new marijuana laws.
It's complicated. I'm because of the mental health collaborative that I'm part of.
I hadn't heard that before, and I think that is an important piece. And that is a huge, yep. I mean, to me, that's a big percent.
Yeah, it's huge. So there's I can't remember if it's 25%, like it's psychosis or mental health disorders get triggered by it. But
still,
that's one of the oldest people who are saying like, oh, I get anxious on it. I get paranoid. That's a symptom of psychosis. That's a lot of people don't realize, like, it's not good. it's a high risk for mental health. And then it also in the bigger picture. So this isn't, I'm personally, everyone can do what they want. I'm on the harm reduction model is what has been shown to be most effective, which is whatever works for you to not cause problems in your life.
Yeah.
Right, for whatever you use with everything, that if it's causing problems in your life, then that's when you have to look at it. So the harm reduction model is really what has been shown most effective to help with substance abuse or alcohol. So whatever doesn't cause a lot of problems is called harm reduction. But with marijuana, with any drug or alcohol, when it's being consistently used, it becomes an avoidance strategy rather than what other people might use as a social thing to drink or even anything. But when you're using it to avoid feeling or using it as a coping strategy, oh, I'm anxious, so I'm gonna drink or smoke. Oh, I'm sad, so I'm gonna smoke or drink. That's when it starts becoming a problem, because then you don't learn other coping strategies.
And that's interesting, because I had one time, I mean literally one time in my life, with drinking, never in my life has it been like, oh, I have to have a drink, I need to calm down, I need to, it's always been a social thing, or, you know, I'd like a drink, or a margarita sounds refreshing, kind of a thing, except for when my godson died, and right before his rosary that night, it was a very conscious thing, too. In my mind, never has that ever happened before or since, where it's like, I need to have a glass of wine before I go do this.
Right. And so, you know, that there's actually some physicians who are like, people with really high anxiety, they're like, try a glass of wine at night. You know, it's not being shown to be that harmful. The problem is when it becomes a habit, your go-to coping strategy is really when it comes to a problem. So I think every, you know, how you're talking about like this very discrete incident.
It was very conscious in my head. It was, you know, so I mean, it was interesting. And I'm wondering if that happens, if it's that conscious for other people who do use it regularly to cope.
Yes, I believe it's even way more conscious than that on a regular basis for some people. And that's where you just have to become careful. I say, are you getting it in an unhealthy relationship with alcohol? You're getting an unhealthy relationship with marijuana. So it's, if you feel like you need it rather than you're choosing to enjoy it. Mm-hmm. So, and you can trick yourself into that too, right? You can be like, I'm choosing this 3 times a day. Right? Versus like, what would happen if you didn't do it? If you feel really anxious without doing it because that whole, solely because you don't have that, then that means you have an unhealthy relationship with that.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because, I mean, obviously the one time I did, when I was conscious in my mind that this is what I really need to do to make it through the next 3 hours.
Yeah.
And it never happened again or anything. But it was, it's kind of funny when you look back on it in a way, because here it was a sad, depressing time.
Right.
But I'm using a depressant to fix depression. That doesn't make sense.
Well, it changes your brain chemistry and it lets you not connect fully with the pain, basically. It gives a buffer.
Yeah.
So there are things in the world that help give buffers when we experience a lot of pain. And it's different in those very discrete situations. The problem is when it, and for kind of for all mental health and substance use disorders, it becomes a problem if it's affecting your relationships, your work functioning, your emotional functioning, your psychological functioning. So even with depression, it's at least five of nine of those symptoms for at least 2 weeks, and it's affecting some area of your life, which obviously if you're experiencing 5 of those 9 symptoms, you're not sleeping. I mean,
probably is affecting you.
Yeah, your concentration at work isn't going well. Your boss is like, hey, you're not quite on it. You know, it's going to be affecting you. So that is in our diagnostic criteria, that it needs to be actually affecting parts of your life. So really with substance abuse, it's, you know, is it affecting you? Well, did you get blackout drunk and do things you totally regret and now you feel guilty and or you missed work or things like that? Okay, now it's affecting your other areas of life. And so that's really versus, you know, your one incident, did drinking affect other areas of your life?
No.
Right. So that's not a problem. And so that's what this discrete incident, it's not a habit, right? It's I would say that would be helpful probably in that situation versus someone who is kind of finding reasons to smoke or drink.
Or what you
eat. Right? They're like,
substances.
Oh, my dog's scratching at the door. I needed a hit. You're looking for things to be stressed about because every day there's problems and stressors.
Isn't that the truth?
Right? So you can find that every day. The difference is, what other strategies do you have? And are you completely connected with what your experience is and self-awareness? Because you consistently start using, you disconnect from reality a little bit. It does create a nice buffer in really overwhelming experiences like you're explaining, but it can start becoming problematic pretty quickly.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, you talk about treating depression. You said the combination of medication and therapy tends to work best. What kind of a time frame do you, I know medication, they can ramp up, ramp down. I mean, it's not like here. It's not like an Advil. You got a headache and you take some Advil and probably 20 minutes, it's gone or subsided.
Yeah.
It takes a little bit of time. Is it really an individual thing depending on how deep the depression has gone or how long it's gone on? Or
So that's a good question. So we kind of think of if it's mild depression, typically psychotherapy alone and short-term psychotherapy is enough to kind of be treated. More moderate depression, it's really up to the client and how bad the levels of functioning are being affected. So whether they want to do medication and or therapy. However, we know it's most effective. We kind of say, if you're willing to do both, let's do it, because we know that's the most effective. But there's quite a lot of people who don't want to be on medication. There's other people who are like, yeah, I just want to do medication. I don't want to do the work in psychotherapy. So they'll try it, and we'll see. But ideally, we want to do both. And so with severe depression, we really want to try to get the person on medication so that they can be functioning high enough to do the work in therapy. Because it becomes a problem if they're so depressed that they can't even, it's either just constant crisis safety planning because they're suicidal, let's say, or they're so depressed they can't even make it to their sessions. They're so depressed they can't do any of the homework that we assign in therapy, that we need to get them functioning enough to actually participate in therapy. So that's when we really kind of say, okay, medication really needs to happen. But if we're saying the more typical standard depression, moderate range, which most people are, and someone decides, yes, let's go for the fastest, quickest way to get this, nip this in the bud, a year of being on antidepressant medication would be ideal. Again, I'm generalizing.
Sure,
huge.
Everyone's different.
Yep. This is information from my training from the psychiatrist at UCSC Family Medicine, who had trained me very well on what was most effective and the evidence shows for is with antidepressants, we want to think of as a year, because that gives it long enough to work, do the work in therapy, and then make sure it's titrated up, because it takes, you don't even feel the effects of it for 6 weeks to 2 months.
Yeah.
Because you're just getting your body used to it and going through, sometimes there's a little bit of side effects, but that's more like digestive side effects and things that go away in the first 2 weeks, if there are any. Some people don't feel like any side effects. And then, but to address the depression or anxiety, that takes 6 weeks to 2 months. And then they could really engage and do the work in therapy, which hopefully is about 3 months of really good work. And then reducing therapy time slowly, slowly, slowly. Sure. And then after that, because the problem that happens is people feel good and they stop taking their meds. And then they relapse into a depressive episode because they'd stop too early.
And there is a chemical imbalance that could come into play where you just need to have the medication.
Right. And so you need to help your brain rewire itself, basically, because when depressions happen, it's learning bad habits, basically bad neurotransmitter habits. So you're giving the medication to help your brain learn, this is what I want to do. And then you learn the behavioral and cognitive strategies to help it out, and you keep doing those. And so your brain learns these healthy pathways. And then you take away all the other things. So that's about a year is ideally you want to say. So even if you're feeling better after 6 months, you still stay on it, because it could be too early and you'll relapse, which happens quite often.
Yeah, I bet. I bet it does. And you mentioned earlier at the start of this, how this is affecting kids, depression. We're seeing an increase in number of kids with diagnosable depression.
Yeah.
Cause maybe social media, seems to perhaps be a correlation there. Yeah. But whatever the cause, it is on the rise. So we start dealing with kids, and you talk about medication, and it affects kids differently than adults, and a lot of some risks going with that. What's the best way for a parent to advocate for their kids in a situation? Because I don't know that kids would necessarily come and say, I'm depressed, or really, it has to start almost with the parent.
Correct. So a lot of times, well, good thing we've had, actually, they're doing screeners now for eighth graders. They're doing suicide prevention, and they do a video about suicide, and they did this down in Gardnerville, I believe, and I think they did it in the schools here. The eighth graders, I believe, and they're going to do it to sixth graders, are all being screened with a suicidal and self-harm and basically a PHQ-9, like I showed you, a depression screener. And then those who screened high are actually going to see seeing counselors, who are then being sent, if there's problems, parents are being contacted. And so we got last year through Gardnerville a couple of referrals that way, and it was really really good, because it could have gone really bad if they hadn't gone through that screener. But if you're a parent and your child is not in a school system that's doing that, you can go online and print a depression screener for teens. Find one that's age appropriate, print one out, and ask your child to fill it out or sit down with them and go over it. Typically, teens are more apt to be honest if they don't have to verbalize it. if you can just kind of write it down. So you can ask your teen to do that. And then once you have that information, you know, explore that with them non-judgmentally.
Uh-huh.
And be very empathetic with them and validate their feelings. Wow, that sounds so hard. I'm sorry, I didn't know you were going through that. Like, I just noticed your grades are falling. Like, I didn't really think about it. I just noticed you've been in your room a lot more, and I just wanted to see. And then seek out mental health care.
Yeah.
Find a counselor.
I mean, I would say as a parent, looking at this list of nine, to me, it would be pretty easy to identify if your child is experiencing any of this. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're spending any time with your child,
yes,
you should, you know, notice these things. But it's a lot harder because kids aren't going to come to you and say this. They're not going to go right. Seek out, I think I need to go to therapy. Right. You know, and that's a tough thing.
Yeah, and I think most people can look back in their childhood and they're like, oh yeah, I remember I was really depressed in like seventh grade when this era. Like, I remember like high school being really hard, not telling anyone. And it's really awkward unless a parent, yeah, someone who's caring and loving comes to you asking you these specific questions and opens up that opportunity. And then the parent can even give behavioral observations. I noticed you look like you've been crying more. I noticed you've been hiding in your room a lot more. Parents check their wrists, check to make sure they're not cutting. If they're wearing a lot of bracelets lately, if they're wearing long sleeves and it's summer, check their bodies to see if they're cutting too.
Yeah, yeah. These are all important things, and get them in. Get that referral if you need one, if your insurance requires. But yeah, it is. It's important because it's scary. I look back and you can see times in life and junior high and different times and things, but life is hard now for kids.
Yes, it is. Well, there's a lot of more pressures. There's a lot more expectations, and with access to the internet and stuff, things are expected to be done faster and have more access, but there's definitely a lot more stressors being put on kids. And honestly, I wish kids played outside more. So much.
I talked to someone really about that yesterday.
Helps so much. Just take the phones away, parents. Take them away. Don't let them have them for more than an hour at night. Take them away before bed. Keep them in your room. This is going to change your child's life.
It is. You know, we go back, we were talking about summer. I mean, I grew up in the time what summer meant was you slept in. It was very exciting.
Yeah.
And you'd wake up, you usually had some chores to do, and then you went out and played.
Yes.
Whatever that was, you know, with your friends and played. It wasn't that, you know, we didn't have play dates. We didn't have scheduled camps every single day.
Yeah.
You know, maybe a week or two in the summer you did some kind of a camp thing, but overall it was just play.
Yeah.
And we are better for it.
I know. I remember going out into the stream out by our house and making little wood boats and racing them down. And we had imaginary worlds of jungles and different worlds we created and tree houses we built. And, yeah, everything from scratch. And it had the best summers. It was great.
Yeah, it's interesting what we've done to our kids. But anyway, we were just talking about that yesterday. It's like, let them play. Let's not overschedule them here.
Yeah.
Let them go. You know, anyway, they don't. Yeah. I digress. but this is interesting information, and I encourage people, you look at any of these symptoms, and they really do affect your life and the quality of life you're living.
Right. And just knowing that it's nobody's fault, right, these symptoms, that it's your brain is sick. Your brain is an organ in the body. All of your organs have the potential to be sick. When there's a mental health disorder, it is a sickness. It needs to be treated. It's a serious thing. It's just like if you had a kidney disorder, you know, if you had your kidney or your stomach ulcer or something, you got to go to the doctor and get treated. Your brain can get sick just like anything else. It has a lot of ways it can get sick. It can get sick from past wounds, trauma. It can get sick from current wounds, grief and loss. And then it can fester if it's not treated. Treating our brain needs to process things, and it can get essentially sick. So what mental health is, and those are the symptoms of when your brain is sick and needs to be treated.
And just, you know, kind of as a kind of weird reminder to everyone, your brain pretty much is you.
Yes. Your consciousness.
I was reading they are actually going to attempting to transplant a head onto a different body. I guess whoever.
What?
Yes, this is true. Look this up. I mean, it's freaky and spooky, because the person obviously has physical ailments in their body, and they're going to, now whether this will work or not, I do not know.
Yeah,
sounds a little sketchy to me, but I'm not a doctor. But it really is. I mean, to think that, you know, we can transplant hearts and other organs. You can't transplant your brain.
Yeah, I need to read about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, so the brain's going, and they're transplanting the body. So we'll be clear about that. The person isn't staying in here. Here's a new brain for you. But it really, I mean, the brain controls everything. Everything in your body.
So is it really a body transplant?
It's a body transplant, yeah.
Okay, so you're giving that brain a different body.
Yeah, so they're... Okay. Yeah. But it just really shows how important your brain is. Because the brain is you. It is what controls everything.
It's your hard drive.
Yeah, you can't... You know, we ignore it. If you had a kidney stone, trust me, you're not going to ignore that.
Right. And that's what headaches are. It's your brain giving you feedback that it needs rest, water, relaxation, something needs to be different, you know?
Yeah, an Advil.
It gives you, a lot of body pains and aches that we have are originated from the brain being sick.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You talked about, you know, having those unexplained physical pains.
Yeah. Because this is our central nervous system, you know, that they all connect throughout our whole body.
And if you've got something glitched up there, it is going to manifest out somewhere. So very important stuff.
Right. And then we didn't really talk about, because this isn't my specialty at all, but there are other integrative forms like cranial sacrum therapy, and, you know, there's acupuncture, and there's other forms of therapies that, depends on who you are, might work for you as well. So I'm just talking about psychotherapy here today, and in conjunction with getting medical treatment from your physician. But other people, you know, it's not one thing for everybody. It's what everybody can try something, but just listening to your brain, knowing those symptoms. And also I want to bring up that in kids, we might look different, especially little kids, and more acting out behaviors and oppositional behaviors and irritability will be seen, because they don't have the words to give for depression.
So
it'll look different in little ones, but essentially, being able to ask for help. You can go to your primary care physician. You could start there, or you can come over to A Balanced Life and call our office at 530-544-1748 to see who's available, if there's a good therapist, is a good fit. You know, we have four therapists there that have different, all of us have different specialties. And whatever you're looking for, you know, we have one who specializes with end-of-life care if you are a family member. And grief and loss. We have another one who specializes with play therapy for kids and trauma and developmental disorders, and others for panic disorder, depression, postpartum depression is one of my specialties, and we have for PTSD, Sarah Marquez, who does EMDR. So we have kind of a whole slew of therapists there. So
that's great.
I encourage everyone to look at our website, abalancedlifetahoe.com.
Make it easy.
Yeah. So if you go to our website, you can just go to the contact page and email, ask questions, or call us.
And that's a nice thing, because, you know, kind of, I think people sometimes are a little more open via emailing or doing something than actually talking to someone initially. So that's a nice little feature to be able to do that.
And some people want to just talk to somebody. And so it's interesting, you know, it varies person by person, but I think definitely for people who are a little more anxious about going that next step, you can just email, and you can just email a question too. You don't have to email and get an appointment right away. You can just be like, can you just tell me about this? Or just go on our website and look at the different providers, because we have listed their little brief blogs for each provider. So, or I guess they're not blogs, they're
little bios.
Bios.
There you go.
Blog. I was like, I knew it was a B word. Something like
Well, this has been absolutely enlightening, and I hope people have some takeaways, and I hope they call you.
Yes, thanks, Jen. I appreciate it. And again, for everyone, to go to our website, abalancedlifetahoe.com.
Guys, make it easy.
Yes.
Lindsay Simon with A Balanced Life. Check them out. They've got their website. They're on Facebook. They're everywhere. And don't let depression get you down. There is something that can be done about it.
Yes, that's the biggest thing. If you get treatment, the rates are extremely high of success.
And, you know, sooner you start, the sooner you'll be out of it.
Yep.
So whatever that road looks like for a person, whether it's a short term or whether it needs to go a little longer, you don't start on it until you start.
Yep.
So
exactly. Thanks, Jen.
You're welcome. Lindsay Simon is here, Kay Tahoe, once a month. Check her out online on Facebook. And gosh, every third Thursday, is that where we're
yes,
at?
Yes, I believe so. Had to count. That's what we're trying for.
Count them out. We do the best we can. We'll see you next month.